Over the past 50 years, television has transformed the political process in Britain, America, and many other countries across the world. American presidential campaigns are totally geared to television, and the winner is almost without exception the candidate who comes over best on television. In Britain, with its prime ministerial system, the relationship is more subtle. But television remains the most powerful form of political communication yet invented, and the means by which most of the voters get most of their information. So I want to look at how successive prime ministers have, over the past 50 years, used and at times abused the cameras. Every modern prime minister has either loved, hated or feared television. Some have done all three. I've been lucky enough to have interviewed and filmed all the last eight prime ministers, from Harold Macmillan to Tony Blair. And I've collected together over the years many remarkable clips of what you might call PM TV, some of them never broadcast before, which I'll be playing in this programme. And I'll end with some modest proposals as to how the relationship between prime ministers and television might be improved. Let me start in 1961. The BBC, with its great fondness for anniversaries, was celebrating 25 years of television in Britain. It had laid on a glittering banquet at the Grocer's Hall in the city, and the guest of honour was the Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. The great and the good, from the BBC's legendary first director general, Lord Reith, to the Archbishop of Canterbury, were all invited. And in those more self-confident days of the BBC, it was an occasion where white tie and medals were worn. In his after-dinner speech, Harold Macmillan reflected on the effect that television was having on his life as Prime Minister.
It is in airports that television chooses to lurk. You go by sea, you go by road, you go by rail, nobody bothers you very much. If you go by air, there it is, that hot, pitiless, probing eye. After 14 hours of travel, you get off the aeroplane wanting only a shave and a bath. Oh no, you are cornered. The light's in your eyes, the camera's whizzing. You put up your hand to shade your eyes. And the next day, there you are. In the Daily Clarion. Looking weary, old, worried, over a caption which implies that you are past it.
I think most of Harold Macmillan's successors would recognise that. Macmillan made that speech when he was at the height of his powers as Prime Minister, and he was dubbed Super Mac. But when he'd first become Prime Minister 4 years earlier, he was by no means as comfortable with the cameras, as you'll hear in a minute. Later in that speech, he said, "Television has introduced a new dimension into politics, and some of us don't quite know what to make of it. But we old dogs have to learn new tricks." When television restarted in Britain just after the war, both the Prime Minister Clem Attlee and the opposition leader Winston Churchill laughed at the idea that television would have any part to play in politics. "It's just a tuppenny halfpenny Punch and Judy show," said Churchill when he returned to power in 1951, and he thought it intolerable that how he looked on television should have any part to play in the voters' minds. But during his final term, the audience rose, partly as a result of the success of televising the Queen's coronation, from a few hundred thousand to over 12 million. Churchill reluctantly decided he should try the TV waters for himself. In strictest secrecy, he arranged to have his own screen test made.
"I've come here not to talk to you, and certainly not to enable you to spread the tale all over the place, but just to enable me to see what are the conditions under which this thing they call TV is going to make its way in the world. I'm sorry, I must admit to have to descend to this level, but we all have to keep pace with modern improvements, and it's just as well to see where you are in regard to it. There's no point in refusing to move with the age, and therefore I have consented to come and have this exhibition. which is for one person and one person only, that only one person is going to judge what is to be done with this and what is to follow from it. So I am that person. There you are. There you see me. I am the one.
Winston Churchill hated his viewing of the screen test and ordered it destroyed. But happily for us, he was disobeyed. When Harold Macmillan became Prime Minister in 1957, he realised he'd have to try to come to terms with television. It was not a prospect he relished. Despite his self-confident public demeanour, he would suffer agonies of nerves and was sometimes physically sick before a big speech or broadcast. He decided to reveal to the viewers exactly what an ordeal it all was for him.
Well, there you are. You can see what it's like. The camera's hot, probing eye. These monstrous machines and their attendants. A kind of 20th century torture chamber, that's what it is. But I must try and forget all this paraphernalia and imagine that you are sitting here in the room with me.
Although Harold Macmillan did learn to use television, he discovered that a prime ministerial image can be a fragile thing. Like the delicate adjustment of focus on a camera, the viewer's perception of a prime minister can subtly alter. Macmillan's unflappability, showmanship and Edwardian élan came to appear fuddy-duddy, contrived and out of touch. The chief beneficiary was Harold Wilson, the new Labour leader. He'd made a study of television techniques and sought to play up a modern, classless image, in complete contrast to those people who he said felt they were born to rule, like the aristocratic old Etonian Harold Macmillan.
About a week ago, I saw the Prime Minister on television. It's a fact, I did. I'm just as much allowed to watch television as any of you. I have my favourite programmes that you have. And this wasn't one of them.
The BBC filmed Wilson on holiday in the Scilly Isles. On camera, he puffed a pipe in place of the cigars that he'd smoke in private. Harold Wilson was the first Prime Minister to try to use television as an instrument of government. He would regularly invite himself onto Panorama, the BBC's main current affairs programme. He once told me that he felt that a Prime Minister should try and look on television like a family doctor, the kind of man who inspires trust by his appearance as well as his soothing words, and, said Wilson, whose advice is always welcome. He sought to associate himself with the stars of the swinging Britain of the 60s, hoping that some of their glamour would rub off on him. He recommended the Beatles for honours and presented them with showbiz awards.
A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Same goes for me. Thank you very much for giving us this silver heart. But I still think you should have given one to good old Mr. Wilson.
But good old Mr. Wilson discovered that those who live by the box can perish by the box. In 1967, after 3 years of insisting that Labour would never devalue the pound, he was forced to devalue by nearly 15%.
From now on, the pound abroad is worth 14% or so less in terms of other currencies. That doesn't mean, of course, that the pound here in Britain, in your pocket or purse or in your bank, has been devalued.
Harold Wilson had shot himself in the foot. The Conservatives had spent nearly 5 years seeking to demolish Harold Wilson's homespun credibility on television. The Prime Minister's own auto-cued words did it for them. Wilson lost the 1970 election to Ted Heath. In his 3.5 years as Prime Minister, Heath never came to terms with television. Despite the efforts of numerous media advisers, he would appear stiff and stilted. He once told me, they discovered there was nothing they could do about it, so they gave up in despair. As Prime Minister, Ted Heath would hold grand televised press conferences in the style of General de Gaulle of France, in the marble and gilt splendour of Lancaster House. But this only intensified Heath's image as a remote authority figure and did nothing to create a personal bond with the audience. In 1974, with the miners on strike and the country on a 3-day week, he called a snap general election. He asked the question, "Who runs Britain?" and sought to appeal directly to the viewers.
I love this country. I'll do all that I can for this country. And isn't that what you want to do too? We've started a job together. With your will, we shall go on and finish the job.
I later put to Ted Heath what one of his closest friends had told me. He'd said Ted's tragedy was that he was never able to project his private charm on television, and this cost him dear at the time of the miners' strike. When I quoted this to Ted Heath, he looked at me with his baleful light blue eyes and replied, "I don't think a miners' strike is the time to come on television and ooze charm. Do you?" When Margaret Thatcher first became Tory leader, she seemed to react to the sight of a TV crew almost as if she thought it might somehow take her soul away. She and her media advisers felt that television would be crucial to overcoming the range of problems and prejudices she faced. Private opinion polls showed that she came over as strident, bossy, uncaring and out of touch with ordinary people. Her two chief media advisers were the former TV producer Gordon Rees and Tim Bell, the head of the Tories' advertising agency, Saatchi & Saatchi. They decided that she should have a complete makeover.
Gordon's absolutely terrific. He knew exactly what needed to be done, and he understood that it wasn't enough to have the right policies. One had to look good in putting them over, and he said my hair had to be changed, and we'd better have a look at the makeup, and we'd better have a look at the clothes, and see how they looked on television and so on. And I hadn't taken any notice of these things before. But he was very good. He was a real professional.
Mrs. Thatcher's advisers were sometimes schizophrenic about whether they wanted to present her as the fluffy or the toughy. Ironically, it was her sworn enemy, the Soviet Russians, who came up with the perfect synthesis, the Iron Lady. It was a phrase that, after initial hesitation, she began to use about herself. But the public itself often veers between wanting a strong leader and one who can relate to ordinary people's problems. So to play up Mrs. Thatcher's human side, Gordon Rees introduced the photo opportunity, beloved of American presidential hopefuls, into British elections. Until 1979, no previous aspirant to number 10 had given an election campaign press conference clutching a two-day-old calf in a meadow, as Mrs. Thatcher did. I asked her about it at the time.
The press say, look, we don't want just another photograph of you. We were with 100 bullocks looking in superb condition. There was this beautiful calf. And after all, we had 70 or 80 cameramen round with us. They have to do their job, and I'm very conscious they have to do their job, and they want a good picture.
I just wondered, there seem to be two Mrs. Thatchers sometimes.
Three, at least.
What are the three?
There's a very logical one. There's an instinctive one, and there's just one at home.
Our love-hate relationship reached a low point 3 years later when a panorama I'd made about the Falklands was attacked in Parliament. A Tory MP got up and asked, and I know the words verbatim because they're on the wall of my loo at home, "Will the Prime Minister take time off in the course of her busy day to watch a recording of last night's panorama, which was an odious and subversive travesty in which Michael Cockerell dishonoured the right of freedom of speech in this country?" I hadn't until that moment realised the programme was quite as good as that. But the Prime Minister rather agreed with the sentiments of her questioner, saying, "There are some people in this country who do not understand their duty in a democracy to stand up for our boys." Margaret Thatcher used the big set-piece formal TV interviews as a favoured method of getting herself across. She would regard these encounters as highly significant, and much tension would surround them. I once asked her what she thought of these big set-piece TV interviews. "I hate them. I hate them. I hate them," she said. She was the first Prime Minister to agree to appear on a chat show. The timing was no coincidence. It was 1984. The miners' strike was at its height. Although the opinion polls showed that a large majority of people blamed the miners' leader Arthur Scargill for the violent confrontations with police that were dominating the TV screens, his attacks on Mrs. Thatcher as dictatorial and uncaring were getting through. She and her advisers calculated that she would benefit from appearing on a programme that showed her human face.
Prime Minister, this is a rather different sort of question time from the sort you were used to. You live over the job at number 10. Is it possible to feel at home there?
I sometimes feel as if I started life living over the shop, and I live over the shop now, because people always come up. Is it possible? Well, I'm always on the job. People think of that.
Margaret Thatcher was the mistress of the unintended double entendre. And that programme showed the hazards for prime ministers of moving out of the traditional mould. But it's a policy that Tony Blair has deliberately followed. The aim is to reach parts of the TV audience that traditional political programmes don't reach. Tony Blair and his two chief media advisers, Peter Mandelson and Alastair Campbell, have devised the most sophisticated approach yet to the media. Mandelson is a former TV producer and Campbell a former tabloid political editor. One part of their strategy has been to play up the image of Blair as a modern, likeable, informal family man. The key thing for Tony Blair, while he was still opposition leader, was to try to convince the voters that what Campbell calls mad old Labour had gone forever. Tony Blair's private pollster, Philip Gould, says that he asked Blair what the heart of his strategy was. Tony's reply was emphatic, says Gould. Reassurance, reassurance, reassurance. Tony Blair learnt a great deal from the media techniques of his friend Bill Clinton. Clinton had won power as a new Democrat. Blair was the first leader of New Labour. In the years since then, there's been a remarkable cross-pollination between the two Oxford-educated lawyers. Sometimes it was Clinton who would come up with the phrases first.
Opportunity and responsibility. They go hand in hand.
And in return for those opportunities, responsibility.
Not bigger government, but more effective government.
Not bigger government, better government.
New ideas for new challenges.
New challenges, new ideas.
But it was by no means all one-way traffic. Sometimes Blair would come up with the phrase first.
And at the time of the next election, there will be just 1,000 days until the new millennium. 1,000 days to prepare for 1,000 years.
Tomorrow there will be just over 1,000 days until the year 2000. 1,000 days to build a bridge to a land of new promise. Let us seize those days and the century.
As Clinton himself said in a televised press conference, standing next to Blair in the Downing Street Garden, all governors should borrow shamelessly from each other. Tony Blair's press secretary, Alastair Campbell, says that it's his job to get Blair over to the public. To do this, he says, we have to try and dominate the news agenda and stay ahead of the media. And we have to find new and creative ways to get our message across. For the first 6 months, it all went swimmingly. Blair's popularity reached record highs. But then came an event that threatened all this, the Bernie Eccleston affair. It was a tangled tale. It involved a £1 million donation to Labour Party funds from the Formula One motor racing boss, Eccleston, followed by the government's decision to change its policy in favour of Eccleston and the tobacco companies that sponsored motor racing. It was all deeply damaging to Tony Blair's carefully cultivated image as a sleaze-free Prime Minister. At first, Alastair Campbell and Peter Mandelson sought to kill the story by silence, and Labour ministers declined all TV invitations to appear, which led to the BBC's Newsnight getting its own back by showing an empty chair in the studio.
And just in case you're wondering, tonight, for the fourth night in a row, we asked the Labour Party if we could talk to a minister on this issue. And as you can see, there is the seat in our Westminster studio, all ready for him or her, but yet again, for the fourth night in a row, it remains untouched by any ministerial bottom.
Eventually, Blair and his media advisers decided the only way to bring about what they called closure was to have the Prime Minister face a tough TV interrogation. At very short notice, Blair agreed to appear on the BBC's On the Record programme.
You've been in power for 6 months and a bit now, and you've had a quite extraordinary period in office. I mean, you have been the most popular Prime Minister since ever. Now the papers are saying that the issue surrounding you is one of trust. Do you believe that as a result of what has happened in this past week or so, you have lost the trust of the British people?
No, I don't believe that. and I hope that people know me well enough and realise the type of person I am to realise that I would never do anything either to harm the country or anything proper. I never have. I think most people who have dealt with me think I'm a pretty straight sort of guy, and I am. And I think that what I would say to you about that, and I do find that these things difficult and upsetting, is I think there's been a desire to say right from the word go, this can't be as good as it looks. You know, they're all the same. The Tories were sleazy, Labour's no different. I don't believe we're like that at all.
But, as the political journalist Andrew Rawnsley put it in a recent book about the new Labour government, Tony Blair's smile was still there, but the Prime Minister had tobacco stains on his teeth. Tony Blair has strictly limited his appearances on the traditional heavyweight political programmes. He's tended to prefer more relaxed TV encounters that reach a different audience, like the programme on daytime commercial television known as The Richard and Judy Show.
Do you agree with Mrs. Thatcher that you're quite bossy? Do you?
Now.
She said, I'm getting a bit worried about that, young man.
You'd have to be bossy, wouldn't you, to be Prime Minister? It's part of the job, I'd have thought.
I mean, I won't say anything about her qualifications for passing the remarks after that. But, you have to be firm as a leader.
Yes.
I don't actually think I'm a very bossy person at all. In fact, I'm pretty easy to get along with. But I do believe when you're Prime Minister, or whether you're leading any organisation, you have to be firm with people. You have to set a clear course and direction.
Listen, we've gone way over. Thank you very much for joining us. You're going to stay on, because actually you can phone Tony yourself this morning and talk to him live. It's the number is the usual one for the phone, and it's your chance to get a one-to-one with our Prime Minister.
Tony Blair says that he's taken part in more question and answer sessions with different sections of the public and appeared on more local radio and TV phone-ins than any previous Prime Minister in history, and he's just done one on the commercial television network. The strategy is to try to get Blair over directly to voters and not have everything filtered through the press, much of which Tony Blair describes as corrosively cynical and often fundamentally dishonest. Earlier this year, Blair and Campbell gave us access to the Downing Street media operation. Their calculation was that a fair report would show that Number 10 is more spinned against than spinning. Alistair Campbell said to me, "The press, hand in hand with the Conservatives, say that everything we do is just spin. It's all part of their strategy to say, you can't trust the Prime Minister, that this guy doesn't really stack up, doesn't stand for anything." We were filming in Campbell's office when Tony Blair suddenly walked in.
Everyone says the importance you put on relations with the media is greater than it's been with any government in the past.
I think it's just modern government now. Look, it's a 24-hour-a-day news media. If a story comes out that says something, and you haven't got the capacity to get on top of it and say, no, hang on, sorry, the facts are X and Y. And as you probably discovered, I mean, it's not as if, you know, these stories don't take a life of their own and then start running away into the far distance, and then the public thinks, oh my goodness, what on earth are they doing that for, when you're not doing it at all? You know, it's important to have the capacity to get on top of the news as far as it's possible, but it's less important to us than I think it is in the way that people perceive it.
After that film went out, Campbell said that he felt the programme had, on balance, justified the risk that he and the Prime Minister had taken in giving us access. "I would give it 7 out of 10, said Campbell. But we had failed, from his point of view, to show the journalists as corrosively cynical enough, nor had we shown how often they get it wrong, or in Campbell's view, just make it up. But when one looks back at how successive prime ministers have themselves sought to use television over the past 50 years, the record is scarcely encouraging. We've seen in Macmillan's phrase how the old political dogs have learnt new media tricks. And to continue the canine metaphor, the broadcasters have alternated between being lapdogs and Rottweilers. As one notably ferocious TV interviewer put it, my attitude to politicians is that of a dog towards a lamppost. In retrospect, some of the efforts of successive prime ministers to use the TV cameras to their advantage can often appear more funny than sinister. Machiavelli is played by Mel Brooks. But I believe that the British public, which now gets most of its information from the small screen, has been consistently short-changed. the politicians and the broadcasters are bound together in a relationship of mutual dependency. They want our audiences, and we want their bodies. There's a distinct limit to the empty chair style of TV journalism. So, I would offer a couple of suggestions as to how things might improve. Instead of seeking to use television just to polish their images and put across pre-packaged messages, our political leaders should screw up their courage to trust the people with the truth, or some of it anyway. They should offer more genuine access to what goes on behind the scenes. And in the coming general election campaign, there should, for the first time in Britain, be a televised debate between the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. For if things continue as they've been going over the past 50 years, then I firmly believe that public disillusion with our political leaders, already at record low levels, will continue to decline further. And the biggest loser of all will be democracy itself.
People in Politics was presented by Michael Cockerell and produced by Elaine Thomas.